Every conversation with people you haven't seen since quarantine started.
It's such a weird time, but things seem to be opening up again. Fingers crossed.
Who the hell is this woman? Is she like my wife's friend, or do our kids go to school together?
Is she my cousin? I feel like I'm flirting with someone that might be my cousin.
He remembers he's my cousin, right? And how many times can a person say, it's such a crazy time right now?
Just such a crazy time right now, you know?
So did you travel at all?
No. You?
No.
Cool.
Is this really a conversation?
I think this is going pretty well.
I think I'm just going to be extra cautious for the rest of my life, you know?
Which vaccine did you get?
I got Pfizer.
I got Moderna.
Nice. A question that leads nowhere. It's like asking, are you more Tylenol or Advil?
Let me guess. The second dose knocked her out for 24 hours.
The second dose knocked me out for about 24 hours.
Wow, that sounds like a unique experience you should tell everyone about. I said that out loud. Quick laugh, so she thinks you were kidding.
Quarantine was good, though?
No.
Great.
But recently I have been going to dinner again.
Did I just say I've been going to dinner again? Should I give him more details or should I die?
I went to one dinner outdoors and one dinner indoors.
Do I have brain damage? I think I might have permanent brain damage.
It's too close. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It's Monday, May 10th. With us, we have White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire, member of the New York Times editorial board, Mara Gay, former Treasury official and Morning Joe economic analyst, Steve Ratner, and U.S. national editor at the Financial Times, Ed Luce, is with us this morning. All right, let's dive right in. A ransomware attack that shut down the country's largest gasoline pipeline was most likely the work of Russians. Two sources tell NBC News a new Russian criminal group known as DarkSide is the leading suspect in the attack against Colonial Pipeline. The company was forced to pause operations that transport nearly half of the fuel supply of the entire East Coast. NBC News sources say early indications suggest the attack did not look like the work of the Kremlin and was rather a criminal plan. DarkSide is known for its extortion plots. Colonial Pipeline has not said what the hackers demanded. Gasoline futures are up nearly 1.5% this morning. Heating oil up nearly 1.3%.
Ed Luce, this is really this is where the future of warfare may be going. You have these asymmetrical attacks that any country can launch if they've invested enough in getting an army of hackers. They don't have to have 50, 60 years of military buildup like the United States. Just do something like this and shut the East Coast down of this country or of Britain or, well, you just fill in the blank.
Yeah, and it's a little bit like the pandemic, and that our vulnerability to cyber attacks, particularly of critical infrastructure, to our critical infrastructure, has been flagged for years and years and years, like pandemics have been. So we know what we're vulnerable to. And in this case, you know, it's an extraordinary vulnerability. This 45% of American refined gas goes through this one pipeline, the Colonial Pipeline. I think the fact that there's an infrastructure bill coming up for consideration before Congress, which is returning from recess, means that this attack might be, in a curious way, quite well timed to focus minds on just how vulnerable our critical infrastructure is to ransomware attacks from private sector criminal groups, but also more geopolitically motivated attacks from countries like Russia. So it's a timely reminder, let's say, of what we need to get done.
Yeah, and Ed, let's, while I have you here, I was reading over the weekend a column by E.J. Dionne talking about how Boris Johnson and conservatives did so well throughout most of Britain. What can you tell us?
Well, there were local elections last week, ordinarily not such huge events. And there was also a by-election in a formerly very, very working-class Labour stronghold of Falmouth. And the Labour Party did very, very badly indeed. It should have done well. We're in the middle of a Conservative government led by Boris Johnson, and that's normally when you know, the protest vote benefits the opposition. But Boris swept most of what we used to call the red wall constituencies that Labour could rely on, and that's caused a leadership crisis in the Labour Party under Keir Starmer. Also in Scotland, the Scottish Nationalists almost swept the board. It was something close to a landslide. So the possibility now of another Scottish referendum on independence is going to be extremely hard for Boris Johnson to put off. So he swept England but lost Scotland, which is kind of in keeping with the whole post sort of Brexit story, that it was really an England nationalist phenomenon, and that England is becoming a Conservative Party stronghold. The rest of Britain, quite the opposite.
Yeah, you know, Steve Rattner, I know you worked for the Times over in Britain for quite some time. It is just absolutely fascinating to look at the map in Great Britain, compare it to what's happened in the United States, and you've got the northern part of the country that's always been so pro-labor and always been so liberal. That was where, really, as you know from your reporting, that's where the teeth of the anti-Thatcher movement was in the north. Now, just as we see in Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania and in our industrial Midwest, old industrial Midwest, upper Midwest, you have Boris Johnson and conservatives winning in Britain in places they never would have won in the 80s or the 90s or even 10 years ago. This is a global phenomenon that we see in every election now, it seems.
Yes, it's a global phenomenon, and it's one, I think, in Britain, just as in the United States, that's driven in part by economics as well as other issues. But you do have large groups of people for whom the economy simply wasn't working under Labour, and who felt that the traditional liberal solutions to these kinds of problems weren't making their lives better, and have decided to try an alternative. And apart from the economic side of it, you do again have the same kinds of social tensions, changing demographies, and concerns among white working class voters there as to how the country's evolving and who's going to be in charge and who their neighbors are and things like that. And so, yeah, you do see a lot of the same phenomenon going on there, as you said.
And should be a note, at least. Democrats should take note that Boris Johnson and conservatives in a race they should have lost are still doing so well in these areas as we move from the pandemic.
Well, back in the U.S., we're following two mass shootings, one in Colorado Springs and the other in the heart of New York City. In Colorado Springs, a man, police say, walked in and shot and killed seven people before taking in his own life. He walked into a birthday party. There were children at the party. None were injured. Police say a gunman was a boyfriend of one of the victims, and there's no word yet on a motive there yet, though they're putting the pieces together, and we're following that. Then go to New York City, where police have identified a person of interest who shot three innocent bystanders in Times Square on Saturday, including a four-year-old girl. Two senior NYPD officials tell WNBC that Farrakhan Mohammed was trying to shoot his brother when the unintended targets were shot. Gun violence has nearly doubled in New York City since the same time last year. Hours after the Times Square shooting, Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams and his political rival Andrew Yang, both among the front runners in the New York City mayor's race, stressed support for the New York City Police Department, rejecting calls of defunding the police, and stated that their beliefs that New York City's economy could not recover without public safety.
So, Mara, I've been following the New York City mayor's race by following a lot of your reporting. from the early part of the campaign. And it's been fascinating how this debate has broken down, where the defund the police sentiments and that campaigning works better than in other areas. And it's not always obvious, just like we were talking about the British voters and where they broke. Talk about the defund the police argument right now as it's breaking down in the New York City mayor's race, and why these two more moderate candidates may have broken out. And I think Andrew Yang even said something like, "We need you, NYPD. Your city needs you, NYPD."
Well, the key to understanding the way this is breaking down here in New York is to understand that in New York City politics, in Democratic politics in New York, Central Brooklyn and Black voters are key stakeholders. And because of that, you have folks like Eric Adams, especially, who's been able to do extremely well in Central Brooklyn. This is his base. And this is a group of people, of communities who, city workers, union workers, they are traditional Democrats, liberal in many areas. But when crime spikes happen, you know, these are the kinds of communities that get hit first. And so that's important to understand. They are communities that are concerned about safety, particularly the voters who tend to be older women, especially, who vote, and union members. So the message that Eric Adams is trying to straddle, and that the other candidates are as well, right, is the need for reform, but also a reflection of the reality on the ground right now, which is that these communities are suffering. And I think it is important, though, that it's really not a binary dynamic here in New York. There's no candidate, including Eric Adams, that is running for office on a law and order message that also doesn't support reform to the NYPD. And I think we really need to pull back and really try and look at the larger picture, which, in my opinion, is that if you have a more accountable police department and you have common sense reform, and that doesn't mean defunding the entire police department, that's ridiculous, right? But if you do have a department that's more accountable to the public that it serves, you will also have a more effective department. I mean, the NYPD has issues, throughout the organization, and it does some things really well, but there are other issues. I mean, its clearance rate, for example, is extremely low. So that's another area where it needs to rebuild trust with communities. And I think the protests that you saw last summer, that energy that you saw throughout the city, the anger over George Floyd's death, which in New York really manifested years after Eric Garner's killing, right? So that is not going to go away. The key for these candidates is capitalizing on the moment of let's really be responsible and be aware that communities are suffering right now. But also, there are going to be reforms that will come too.
All right. Meanwhile, lawmakers may be close to a deal on policing reform, and House Majority Whip James Clyburn said yesterday that he may be willing to support the legislation, even if it does not end qualified immunity.
Are you willing to pass the bill that has most of what you want, but just not the end to qualified immunity?
Well, you know, I will never sacrifice good on the altar of perfect. I just won't do that. I know what the perfect bill will be. We have proposed that. I want to see good legislation, and I know that sometimes you have to compromise. If you don't get qualified immunity now, then we'll come back and try to get it later. But I don't want to see us throw out a good bill because we can't get a perfect bill.
Jonathan Lemire, peace may break out here. It looks like this is one of the first areas where we're having a really healthy back and forth between Republicans and Democrats, and quite a few South Carolina people involved, from, of course, Jim Clyburn to Tim Scott to Lindsey Graham. They're all working together trying to find a middle ground for police reform.
Yeah, Joe, there is some actual momentum here, and there's been so little of it on Capitol Hill in recent years, and certainly since the beginning of the Biden administration, where it looked like something could come together between the two parties. The Republicans have made clear that on most issues, they just want to be the party of no. Mitch McConnell said out loud last week that his purpose as Republican Senate leader was to object and to block 100% of the Biden administration's proposals. But this is one where there seems to be at least some common ground. Qualified immunity, of course, is sort of enshrined protection from individual officers so they can't be sued in the wake of potential misconduct. And it is something that civil rights activists for a long time, police reform activists, have wanted removed. And it was striking to see Clyburn sort of step out of that yesterday and to say that, look, even if we can't come to agreement on that, we need to make something happen. And you nailed it. South Carolina seems to be the nexus of this, with Tim Scott, the Republican senator, taking the lead for his party on this issue. And there has been progress made on a number of issues on policing in the wake of the guilty verdict in the George Floyd murder trial, which, as Mara just said, really was the impetus for so much of this across the country. Now, almost a year ago, with protests sweeping from coast to coast and refocusing sort of the national attention on this issue. And sadly, we've had a number of very questionable police involved shootings since then. So there is some hope here, even though there isn't much common ground on the issue of guns, very sticky negotiations await on things like immigration. And frankly, right now, we're facing a real, the White House and Democrats and Republicans don't seem to have, they seem to be very far apart on this infrastructure and jobs package the president has put forth, and they're going to be meeting in person this week. But on policing, there seems to be some hope.
Well, and Ed Luz, last week I saw Jim Garrity write that the dirty little secret about this huge debate over the whether Democrats could get to 50 votes or not if they get rid of the filibuster was the fact that they can not only get to 60 votes on a lot of these issues, but they're having trouble getting to 50 votes because of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. It seems to me that while many of us were distracted last week by what was happening in the Republican caucus with Liz Cheney and Kevin McCarthy, that really, if you step back, the big story is that Joe Biden gave one of the most sweeping progressive states speeches of our time a few weeks back. But here we are 2 weeks later, and you sit there wondering, well, is he going to be able to get to 50 votes, let alone 60 votes, on 90% of those measures, which means they're going to have to figure out a way to compromise with Republicans. They're going to have to figure out a way to get some Republicans on their side, or that legislation's not going to move. Whether you like the legislation, hate the legislation, are ambivalent about the legislation, that's just the political reality. And that's the one thing I think a lot of people are overlooking in Washington right now. They've got to figure out how to get 10 Republicans on board. Or, if you believe Joe Manchin, none of this stuff's going to pass.
Yeah, and I think the fact that the White House is beginning to move in that direction, you know, it's signaled a lot more willingness to compromise with Republicans in the last few weeks, explains why Bernie Sanders is getting so frustrated. Because whilst Joe Manchin has one vote, which is enough to kill any Democratic bill that goes through reconciliation on the 50 vote basis, so does Bernie Sanders. He has one vote that can kill it. And I think that tussle now is going to get a lot more intense, because I think the Sanders theory of the case, which I happen to share, is that there is no compromise Republicans are willing to make that would preserve the sort of main features of what Biden wants to get done. So I think that Sanders intervention is going to get stronger, and it's going to be heard in the White House. I should mention, Joe, that when you asked me about the British election results last week, I accidentally referred to the constituency of Falmouth, not Hartlepool. Hartlepool is the traditional Labour stronghold in which they were wiped out. And it's a fascinating subject, but I don't want to get the name wrong, particularly since I'm from Britain.
Yeah, so Jonathan Lemire and I were rubbing our chins about that, quite confused. No, actually, we weren't. But thank you for clarifying it anyway for our listeners in Britain. Mara, let me ask you really quickly about this question. Bernie Sanders upset about the possibility of these negotiations and Biden dealing with Republicans too much. How did Democrats get to 60 or better than that? How do they get to 50? How do they get any of this passed if they don't figure out how to pull some Republicans on their side?
Yeah, there's going to be some machinations behind the scenes on Capitol Hill, surely. You know, I think that Bernie Sanders is flexing political muscle here. But I do believe that there's probably a fair amount of deal making going on behind the scenes. I think Democrats can probably get there. It might involve it might be expensive. You might have to the Democrats may find themselves and Joe Biden may find himself having to lean, bend over not only for Joe Manchin, but also for the left wing of the party. And I don't actually believe it's only Bernie Sanders. I think he may be speaking for a larger constituency. You have folks like Ocasio-Cortez, too, on that side, and they can make a lot of noise. So it's a balancing act. But I don't actually think it's a deal that's that far away.
So President Biden is using last week's lackluster jobs report as evidence to help pass his $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan. The U.S. economy gained 266,000 jobs in April, far short of the more than 1 million economic analysts predicted. Here was the president's response.
Today's report is a rebuttal to the loose talk that Americans just don't want to work. I know some employers are having trouble filling jobs. But what this report shows is that there's a much bigger problem. It is that our economy still has 8 million fewer jobs than when this pandemic started. The data shows that more workers are looking for jobs, and many can't find them.
After the jobs report, the Chamber of Commerce called for an end to the extra $300 in federal unemployment benefits, saying it's keeping people from returning to work. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen refuted that idea. It's interesting, Joe, because there seems to be a real opportunity for a lot of people to work, and yet they're not coming out. Those numbers were stunning.
Well, and you and I have heard from people. Steve Rattner, I don't know about you, but we've heard from, I've heard from a couple of very, very liberal Democrats who own restaurants who have told me, I just can't get workers. I voted for Biden, and yes, I'm glad the relief package passed, but, the $1,400, the $300 supplemental unemployment insurance, I can't get workers to come in. And this is something we even heard last summer with a more modest relief package from last summer, where we had people in the sort of travel and leisure and the hospitality areas of the economy could not get workers in because they had received federal benefits. And again, I know this isn't the case with everybody that receives those benefits, and I'm glad people are receiving those benefits. But Steve, we haven't talked about this. And this is impacting Democratic employers as much as it's impacting Republican employers.
That's right, Joe. So let me take you through a few charts to sort of lay out what the Friday jobs report tells us and what we've learned in general about the state of the labor markets. It's a complicated issue, and the president's right. There are issues on the demand side for labor. There are issues about supply chain shortages, but there are also issues about the supply of labor. And so what this chart shows, compares, is employers looking for people to work versus people actually applying to work. The light blue line are job openings, which, as you can see, have recovered nicely from the downturn and have, in fact, shot up. The number of job openings in this country is now higher than it was before the pandemic struck. In other words, the number of jobs that are available is higher than it was before. But the number of people applying for jobs has actually stayed very depressed throughout this period of time.
So let me stop you right there.
And there are, of course, a number.
Let me stop you right there, Steve. So tell me, I mean, that is a massive gap. I don't know that I've ever seen a gap like that, where the job openings are that much higher than the applications for jobs. Why? First of all, have you ever seen a massive gap that big? And why is it that big? And why do we have more job openings now than we had even before the outbreak of COVID?
We have more job openings now than we had before COVID because we have 8 million fewer jobs. And employers are trying to fill a lot of those jobs. So there are a lot of openings as they look for people to fill them. And you've had companies like Uber and Domino's and Pilgrim's Poultry, which is a big chicken processor, all saying we can't find enough workers, as you just said in your opening. The National Federation of Independent Business says that 44% of its members are having trouble filling jobs, which is the highest number they've ever seen. But to talk about the reasons, let's first talk about people dropping out of the labor force. And so what's happened, if we can go to the next chart. So what's happened during the pandemic, which is normal, is that when joblessness hits, a lot of people drop out of the labor force. You can see the dotted black line is the overall labor force. And you can also see it was a lot worse among blacks and Hispanics and also women because they occupy many of the jobs that were eliminated during the pandemic, restaurant workers, hotel workers, and folks like that. And you can see that the labor participation rate has really not come back very far, very fast. There are now 2 million more women who've dropped out of the labor force and 1.5 million men who've dropped out of the labor force. So the labor force as a whole is 3.5 million people smaller than it was before the pandemic. These are not people who dropped out to collect unemployment insurance. They're not collecting unemployment insurance. We'll get to that in 1 second. These are people who dropped out maybe because they're baby boomers like me and they decided they'd work long enough. It's time to call it a day. They may be people who have kids at home and they have childcare problems and they can't work. So they're not out there looking to work. And the consequences have been very high. We have black unemployment up to 9.7% compared to 3.6% before the pandemic. But part of it is that, as I said, that there's a supply of labor problem in terms of people out of the labor force, not because of unemployment, but simply because for one reason or another, they don't want to work. But we can turn now to the next chart and we can get right to your point, Joe, about the effects of unemployment insurance on work. Now, we don't know. There's no way to study who's actually not working because of the unemployment insurance and so forth. But what we can look at is the comparison between what a worker gets on unemployment versus what a worker gets by working. This happens to be for the state of Pennsylvania because these benefits are all calculated state by state. And so what you can see on the left is for a minimum wage worker, and Pennsylvania doesn't have a special, its own minimum wage, so it uses the $7.25 federal, a worker who was earning the minimum wage would collect $11.23 per hour on unemployment. And then you can see a number of professions across here where the amount of unemployment is either larger than the median wage or very close to it. Everything from dishwashers, hotel clerks, preschool teachers, light truck drivers, and so forth. And then if you look at the right, you can see that the median wage in Pennsylvania of $20.08 an hour is not that far above the $17.78 an hour that you get on unemployment. I would also mention in this context that we have sent out a lot of stimulus checks, and that has also put money in people's pockets and may lead them to feel like I don't really need to go back to work right at this moment. Look, I don't want to overstate this. I don't want to claim this is the entire answer to the issue of how many jobs are out there. But it is a much debated subject among economists, and it's very hard to see how it doesn't play some role in the overall picture that we're looking at.
Right. It certainly plays some role. And you don't know. We won't know probably for another year or so when we get all the research in. Certainly, there are several people in the workforce, a lot of people in the workforce who probably don't want to go back until either they're vaccinated or their children are vaccinated or they feel safer going back into the workforce. But that, all that being said, Jonathan Lemire,
This is an issue that's been talked about not just among Republicans, but among Democrats and quite a few Democratic economists. I want to put this chart back up that was just up a second ago. And while people in the media may not be talking about this much because it's very easy to draw the wrong conclusions out of having a truthful conversation about this, like people are too, you know, people might listen to an argument like this and go, oh, you think people are too lazy to stay at home? No, no, what a lot of economic incentives. And while people in the media don't want to talk about this, you look at the first one, two, three, four, you look at the first four categories there, and I guarantee you Republicans are going to have charts like this. They're going to circle it, and they're going to say that Joe Biden made it easier to stay home and collect unemployment than to go out and work. And that's what Democrats need to prepare themselves for in 2022. So what is the White House response to that? I know they're on top of this. I've talked to you, and I know that they're concerned about it. What are they saying?
Yeah, well, certainly Friday when the jobs report came out, the White House and most economic analysts were blindsided by it. There was an expectation of adding like a million jobs. And of course, got nowhere near that. And we heard from the president on Friday. He's going to speak again today on this very subject. And he's going to continue to make the case that this shows the need for more federal intervention, that people aren't safe and they're taking it. You know, people aren't feeling comfortable to go back to work and they need some help. An example, they point to something like childcare, where, you know, for so many Americans, working parents, particularly mothers, unable to rejoin the labor force for the last year or so because they couldn't send their child to childcare because they were fearful of the virus or something was closed or they couldn't afford it. And now they're saying with the jobs infrastructure and particularly the human care aspect of it, that there'll be money for that, that there'll be childcare funding that will allow Americans to send their children to a facility that will allow them to then go back to work. So they're going to take that other angle. But this is something that, of course, they recognize makes their sell a little bit harder. As you said, Republicans spent the weekend already sharpening their talking points about exactly this, saying that the aid is too great. There's no need for another big package like this. It's too much in the way of spending. And this is going to be a vital week on this. And it's all connected because we shorthanded the infrastructure plan from the president, but it's much, much bigger than that. It is a reshaping of how the government interacts with its citizens. There's so much money behind it. It's infrastructure, it's jobs, it is that human child and family care. And this is the week where the White House is going to have a couple of very key meetings on it. Biden's first meeting with the Big Four, which includes the Republican leadership, his first face-to-face with Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy since taking office. That's Wednesday. And then on Thursday with a group of Republican senators that they feel like if there is any hope for a compromise to get at least part of this done, the hard angle aspect of the deal, bridges, roads, highways, it would be with those Republicans and then maybe a Democratic-only vote down the road for that human health and family care aspect of it. But they know they have to do a lot of selling here, and they're not married to the size of it. They've been sending signals the last couple of days. They're willing to back off a little bit on the corporate tax rate hike and willing to back off a little bit on the overall size. They'd be willing to shrink this package some to maybe make it more palatable and get some bipartisan support.
So, Steve Rattner, to sum this up, I don't know if we can put that graph up one more time of unemployment paying better than the real jobs that people had out there, the real jobs that are available. Waiting to hear from what the president has to say today, but you look at these numbers of Pennsylvania, $725 an hour. That person is not living far above the poverty line or perhaps below. So is there an argument within all this? And I know the administration has to really, really navigate carefully over the coming weeks, but is there an argument in here for raising the minimum wage?
Well, sure, there's absolutely an argument for raising the minimum wage for any number of reasons, because as you say, it's not a living wage. Pennsylvania, for whatever set of reasons, has chosen not to have a higher minimum wage of its own. Many states like New York and so forth do. One encouraging thing in the jobs report, and it has to do, ironically, with the fact that many people have dropped out of the labor force or otherwise not looking that hard for work, is that wages are starting to go up. Employers are finding themselves in a position of having to raise wages because they can't get enough people to work. So in a perverse way, this unemployment insurance benefit has, which may have discouraged workers or kept workers from looking actively for work, is then on the other side forcing employers to raise their wage rates. Look, I think that it's a very complicated situation. There are any number of reasons for why The economy is behaving the way it is. I do think there's a chance that this number, this 1 month number was a bit aberrational. And as I said, there are problems all on different parts of it. But the problem we don't have at the moment, is too little money in the economy. There's an enormous amount of money in the economy from the previous rescue packages, from all the money people have saved over the past year, from the stimulus checks. And so while I'm very supportive of the president's jobs plans and so forth, getting that money into the economy is not the problem at the moment. The problems are elsewhere when it comes at least to these kinds of unemployment numbers.
And as Steve said, the good news is from all of this, in a roundabout way, this has actually forced larger employers to raise their minimum wage up to $13, $14, $15. I think Costco may even be at $16 an hour. But again, one more warning. As Maura said, we keep talking about getting those Republicans on board. You move too far toward the Republicans, and then suddenly the House that everybody's been taken for granted is following behind Joe Biden. Suddenly you start having problems with defections from the House because, of course, the Democrats only have a four vote cushion there as well. So, yeah, there's going to be some sort of rough legislative sledding ahead.
Steve Rattner, thank you very much. And Ed Luce, thank you as well. And still ahead on Morning Joe, with the future of the Republican Party in question, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy officially supports ousting Liz Cheney as GOP conference chair. Plus, demand for coronavirus vaccines appears to be plummeting in states across the country. What it means for the race to get more Americans vaccinated. And what Dr. Anthony Fauci is saying about the indoor mask debate. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back. It is 40 past the hour. Welcome back to Morning Joe. It looks like a rainy morning in Times Square. Some states are asking the federal government to withhold portions of their COVID-19 vaccine allocation as demand for the shots drop. The demand shortage in states from Washington to South Carolina is causing the U.S. stockpile to grow by the hundreds of thousands of doses, giving a glimpse at the vaccine hesitancy hurdle that the country is facing. The Biden administration announced that if states don't accept their full allocation, it will reallocate surplus to meet demand in other states, and the U.S. will start sharing its supply with other countries. Not all states are reducing delivery. New York, Colorado, and Maryland are all accepting their full allocations, though demand is dropping slightly. 57% of Americans have had at least one dose. But health experts have stated that about 70% of the population will need to be vaccinated to reach herd immunity. And we are still not there. Meanwhile, as more and more Americans get vaccinated, Dr. Anthony Fauci now says he's open to relaxing indoor masking.
As more people get vaccinated, the CDC will be almost in real time, George, updating their recommendations and their guidelines. But yes, we do need to start being more liberal as we get more people vaccinated.
And Mika, that's what you heard last week from Scott Gottlieb saying it was time. He was talking to Shep Smith on CNBC and said it is time to start talking about lifting mask requirements indoors. That is so important to get this country moving back again. You know, you can do that. You can only if you feel the need to only let a certain number of people into the store, or if you're a shop owner and you only want to have people in that have been vaccinated, that certainly is up to you as a private business owner, or it certainly should be if this is still a free country, as some of my former Republican brothers and sisters might say. But it's time. It is time to move past most of these mask mandates, as, again, over 57% of Americans have at least been vaccinated once.
You know, Dr. Fauci said that masks during cold and flu season might become the norm going forward. I could see people using masks on planes. I'm not against it, but, you know, if someone's not comfortable with that, that's fine, too. But you really saw not just the coronavirus being curbed by social distancing and mask guidelines, but the number of people who got the flu and all, you know, you can't pass as much around from person to person. It's something to think about.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is. You think about going over this past year, year and a half, and again, because of wearing the mask.
I always get the flu.
Because
we didn't get it.
And you didn't get the flu. So many of my friends didn't get the flu. I didn't get the flu this past season because, again, you're wearing a mask. You're being more careful. It certainly makes sense in the future if that's what you want to do. Now, if you like the flu, if you like COVID, okay, if you like smoking like 5 or 6 cartons of cigarettes a day, you know, up to you. It's a free country. People should be able to make that choice on their own. But it does. It really was revealing this past year, wasn't it, Mika?
Mm-hmm.
That if you wear masks when you're on planes, if you wash your hands a little bit more, you can actually even avoid the flu and colds.
I'm pretty sure this conversation will continue as we navigate through this, because we're definitely at 57%, not where we need to be for the country to reach herd immunity, but getting there. Let's move to Afghanistan. The death toll from a car bombing outside an Afghan high school is now at least 68, as concerns grow about the U.S. removal of troops from the country. The blast happened as the classes of all girls were leaving school in Kabul, and was followed by 2 other explosions. According to the New York Times, a witness reported speaking to a man shaking with nerves in this car shortly before the attack. The man reportedly told him to mind his own business. No group has taken responsibility for the bombing. This is horrific. Joining us now, Washington anchor for BBC World News America, Caddy Kay, and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, retired 4-star Navy Admiral James Stavridis. He is Chief International Security Diplomacy Analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. And Joe, I know we don't know exactly where this came from, who this came from. No one has claimed responsibility. But the immediate concern most people had about the pullout from Afghanistan was the impact on women.
Yep, impact on women, impact on young girls who we have been talking to for 20 years and been assuring them that they could go to school, that they would be safe, that the United States would take care of them, that this was a new time, this was a new era. Admiral Stavridis, it doesn't take much imagination to figure out exactly why this was done and done to show the United States of America that Afghanistan's not our country and we're going to be leaving. And whether it's ISIS or whether it's the Taliban, they're going to hunt down and kill these young women who are trying to get an education.
Yeah, Joe and Mika, you know me, and I'm a pretty optimistic person, but this one really shakes me as someone who spent so much time in Afghanistan as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, leading that NATO mission, and often visited these schools. This was something we would point to with great pride. These were girls, 11 to 15 years old. And I really commend our colleague, Richard Engel's reporting, which has been running over the last few days. This is heartbreaking. And sadly, I think this is only a taste of what is to come if the Taliban completely take over the country of Afghanistan. Now, before we leap to that almost apocalyptic outcome, let's recognize that this scene plays terribly in Afghanistan as well as it does in the United States, in that this will repulse people. Many will further denigrate the Taliban. I don't think this does them any favors. It certainly has the hallmark of their ongoing campaign against girls and women, which in many ways is the worst element of the Taliban.
Well, and I know you remember this, Admiral Stavridis, because you lived it and were there in the war zones. But I remember a Jordanian wedding that was bombed in 2006, I believe it was, that so repulsed the people of Iraq. And scenes like that by Zarqawi so repulsed the people of Iraq, especially Western Iraq, that it made your job, it made the United States' job in trying to turn some of the people in the El Anbar province away from Al-Qaeda and these terrorists. to actually start working against them. So explain how that happens. Explain how this imagery actually turns more Afghans against not only the Taliban, but also and especially ISIS.
Yeah, your example is apt, Joe. This was what we called the Anbar Awakening. Many of my senior colleagues who are leading that fight in Iraq were able to weave that into our messaging, and it had a palpable influence on the people of Iraq. And I think that this kind of event may have the same catalyzing effect. We'll see. It's worth remembering when we say the Taliban, it's a very, if you will, diverse organization that runs from super hardliners who would sign up for an act like this to Taliban who are willing to think about coming into the government as partners with Ashraf Ghani, the current president. So it is a spectrum, and one can hope cautiously, I suppose, that this would have a salutary effect on those elements in the Taliban. But the real target here is the people of Afghanistan, and I think they have to be as repulsed as we are by these photographs.
Now, and Catty Kay, I know you have a question for the admiral, but it also we also have ISIS that is now not only trying to kill Americans and trying to kill young women, but also trying to kill members of the Taliban because of the fighting that they have, the reasons they have to battle them. So you actually have several elements competing with each other to see who can become the more radical and the more deadly for the Afghan people.
Yeah, there's a few things that are really interesting and telling about what happened here. This was actually a mixed school. It did teach girls and boys, but it taught the boys in the morning and the girls in the afternoon. And the attack took place at 4 p.m. So definitely targeting the girl part of the school population. It's also in an area of Afghanistan that is largely Shiite, the Hazari community. And they've felt under attack from Islamic State for a long time, that they've been targeted by them. So it is possible that this was an Islamic State attack and not a Taliban attack. The Taliban have actually condemned the attack as well. But I think what it points to is that even if it was Islamic State and not the Taliban, it doesn't suggest that the Taliban have very much control over Islamic State in certain areas of the country, and certainly nor do the Afghan government forces. And I guess the question for you, Admiral, is what's the American role going forwards really going to be in Afghanistan? We're going to be limited, it seems, to some eyes over the country with drones flying from the Persian Gulf to the extent that you can really keep eyes on that very mountainous country. Presumably we'll have some clandestine forces in the country, but clearly the goal is not going to be to protect Afghan girls and Afghan women. So what is the goal going to be after U.S. forces have pulled out? Realistically, what can America do in Afghanistan after those 2,500 troops have pulled out?
Yeah, Catty, this is the gut question. And I'm old enough, I know you're not, but I'm old enough to remember the 1970s when we left Vietnam. And in Vietnam, the key thing which maintained the government in South Vietnam for almost 3 years was funding for the Afghan security forces. And I believe that if we continue to fund the Afghan security forces and we can share that burden with our allies who have indicated they will sign up to it, it's in the a couple of billion, $4 billion a year. It's not nothing, but in the comparison of events like this, I think it's very reasonable. So funding the Afghan security forces. Second, your point, intelligence. The CIA is not pulling out of Afghanistan. And you will see, I think, eyes on the ground alongside satellites, overhead imagery, drones, as you say. So intelligence and information shared with the Afghans. And third and finally, we'll maintain the ability to come in over the horizon. And that will not directly impact girls and women. But if we are coming over the horizon, it will be to go after targets like the Islamic State or other highly radicalized elements that will perhaps have some positive effect. But your point is right. The U.S. is stepping away from this. It becomes, if you will, an international effort at this point. Let's hope our allies, partners, and friends will continue to support Afghanistan.
So let's talk about the pipeline, the sabotaging of the pipeline. Admiral, is this a scene of things to come, a dress rehearsal of sorts for countries like Russia or North Korea that that spend an inordinate amount of time and attention and money on figuring out ways to engage in asymmetrical warfare against us?
Unfortunately, it is. And I spent way too much time as a NATO commander focused on cybersecurity. This time, the attack, which appears to be done by an organization called DarkSide, which, by the way, doesn't attack targets inside Russia or former Soviet Union countries, is a ransomware attack. They cut off or purported to be able to cut off the supply of gasoline to the East Coast. The company has worked through that. Unclear whether they paid a ransom. Almost certainly they did. But Joe, your point, what if it was Russia cutting off not gasoline, but electricity? And does that sound like science fiction? Well, maybe, except in 2015 and 2016, Russia cut electricity to the western half of Ukraine. So these cyber weapons are approaching very high levels of effect in societies. We ought to be very concerned about Russia's capability and China, and right behind them, North Korea and Iran. I'll conclude by saying the administration is moving in the right direction here. They've created the first cybersecurity director, a brilliant man named Chris Inglis, who is a former deputy at the National Security Agency, a one-star retired. We've got the right people coming at this problem.
All right, Admiral.
Admiral James Stravitis, thank you very, very much for being on this morning. And still ahead, new questions about a possible cheating scandal after the horse that won the Kentucky Derby failed a post-race drug test. What does it mean for the Preakness Stakes this weekend? Morning Joe is coming right back.